This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. As a media columnist for The New York Times, our first guest, David Carr, investigates the business of journalism and analyzes new developments in the media, including print, digital, film, radio, and TV. He's the breakout character in the documentary Page One, which followed the Times media desk during a tumultuous year. It was a year that included layoffs at the paper, the New York Times publication of the WikiLeaks documents, and the introduction of the iPad. The documentary has just come out on DVD. Carr also is the author of the 2008 memoir The Night of the Gun, about his addiction to drugs and alcohol and his recovery. Terry spoke with David Carr last week.
David Carr, welcome to Fresh Air. So last night I was checking your tweets, and you said that you know your cold is a common cold if you go to the pharmacy and they're out of all your favorite remedies. And I thought, oh no, my guest for tomorrow has a cold. Maybe he'll be too sick for the interview. Maybe he'll have laryngitis. You really had me worried.
Isn't it important that you knew that I was having trouble finding my medicine at the drugstore? I mean, well, yeah, I thought it was important to share that with the world.
Well, I was wondering, what made that tweet worthy? Why did you decide to tweet that?
Because sometimes you want to grab what is in the air, so to speak, and just put it out there. One time after the Winter Olympics ended, I am a Winter Olympics freak. I just love them. And I think 2 days after it ended, I just said, I miss the Olympics. Well, that got retweeted almost more than anything I've ever written about. And it's just something that's in the air. And so I don't like to do health tweets or food tweets because you're going to end up sort of in a very banal territory very soon. But I thought it was remarkable that sort of wall to wall at a drugstore in New York, all the cold remedies were gone. And so that other people would sort of nod their head when they read that.
How have Twitter and other social network sites changed your reporting? Like, how do you use them as a reporter?
I think the fundamental thing that has changed is I would be someone that would, after I woke up, would check an RSS feed, meaning a feed of all the sites that I'm interested in, and I would browse that feed and see what was of interest to me. I think of Twitter, I follow about 600 people, many of whom are in my business or share my interest, as kind of a human-enabled RSS, and what they're reading and thinking about at any given moment is of interest to me, and it serves to sort of edit what's going on in the world, and it puts a human sort of curation on this huge fire hose of data that's washing over us all the time. You know, the question becomes where to look, and it's nice to have some other people pointing the way.
So just another thing about how your journalism is changing because it's on different platforms. When one of your articles is in the New York Times online, if there's any mistakes that were made in the article, those mistakes are corrected at the bottom of the article. It used to be that corrections were kind of buried in like page two or something. Nobody ever saw them. So your mistakes, your errors weren't like following you around, but they are now. What's that experience like of having the mistakes corrected at the bottom of the article?
You know, I have to tell you, when I got to the New York Times, which was about 10 years ago, I was paralyzed by the idea that my reporting lacked the professionalism and efficacy required to be in the New York Times. I had done a lot of writing and done a lot of reporting, but I now was at a place where kind of the size of the megaphone and its sort of history made it all the more powerful, and that if I said something that was unfair or untrue, that I could snap somebody's career in half like a dry winter twig. And sure enough, after I started, I quickly ended up on page two in the corrections. And you used the term buried. They're not buried to us. That is a hall of shame there, and it's a page you want to totally stay off of. And it's material to your sort of career there. So it's very, very important. And it doesn't matter where error occurs, it always follows you around. And part of the deal with working at the New York Times is that your readers, a portion of whom are kind of church ladies and copy ninnies and fact freaks, they wait like crows on a wire for you to make the slightest error and then descend caw, caw, cawing every time you screw up. And it still is something that that wakes me up at night after I've written something. I wonder if I got something right. And so the fact that now they follow me around like tin cans on the internet, at least on the web, you can amend. You know, the ethic of the web is to say what you know as quickly as you can and then reiterate over and over again. The web is kind of a self-cleaning oven, and what you have up there could grow more efficacious, more accurate as time goes by. That's never true of print. It's always there for the ages to haunt you if you got it wrong.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Carr. He writes a Monday column on the business of media for the New York Times. And he's also one of the people followed, really the main person followed, in the documentary Page One about the media desk of the New York Times. And that documentary is now out on DVD. You had a story that was headlined, "Why Not Occupy Newsrooms?" And you're basically asking how come there isn't an Occupy movement in newspapers, because newspaper executives are guilty of some of the same things that bank executives are. Make the analogy for us.
Well, in the instance of Gannett, Gannett is a publicly held company that owns 82 newspapers across America in towns big and small, dailies and weeklies. And in the past 6 years, they've gone from 52,000 employees to 32,000 employees. Their stock price, which is the general metric of publicly held companies' health, went from $70 a share to about, or $75 a share to about $10 a share. The guy who oversaw it, the CEO, Craig Dubow, when he left, received $37 million in health compensation and disability benefits. And it seemed, I mean, to me, the Occupy movement is a lot of people tag it as socialist or communist. I just think it's people who are angry about capitalism not working. If you make bad choices, you pay the price. In this instance, and at the Tribune Company, which I also wrote about, the chief executives made choices that resulted in a lot of people getting rolled out of the back of the truck. Now, it was a very challenging environment for newspapers, but I don't think that people should benefit in the tens of millions of dollars for just firing people. There's no innovation there. There's no magic to that, and I don't think that kind of sort of thinking and strategy should be rewarded. So I don't know. I just wrote what was basically a screed. And oddly enough, it was weird for me. I was writing about newspapers, and it totally connected on Twitter. And I thought, well, Twitter does not care about newspapers, and yet this thing is rolling over and over again, being retweeted thousands of times. I got probably 300 emails. What is it about this? And what it is, it's about the trashing of once great American institutions, and that's a story that the general public never tires of.
So what was different in terms of how you handled this article and how you typically handle articles that are investigative or critical of the organization that you're writing about or the company you're writing about?
Well, I had done a story a few months ago about Gannett's bonuses, and I spent 4 days trying to get the company to comment on what they did. And on Sunday night, just before a deadline, they said, "We're not going to have any comment on these bonuses." And I just said, "Really? Your newspaper company, your publicly held company, these bonuses are a matter of public record, and you have nothing to say about them?" And I just found that appalling. And I think some of that was sort of reflected in the fact that, A, I didn't bother to call them, and B, that I was angry. after I'd written about their last set of bonuses, that they clearly were living a life beyond consequence, and they just stepped up and did it again and gave this guy a huge bag of money on the way out the door.
Do you feel like, as a reporter who covers the business of media, that you are reporting on the dismemberment of your own profession?
No, I think I'm living through a golden age of journalism, actually. I do think that there's been horrible frictional costs, but I think when we look back sort of at what has happened, I look at my backpack that is sitting here, and it contains more sort of journalistic firepower than the entire newsroom that I walked into 30, 40 years ago. It's connected to the cloud. I can make digital recordings of everything that I do. I can check in real time if someone's telling me the truth. I have a still camera that takes video that I can upload quickly and seamlessly. And I think that the ability to sit at your desk and check everything against history and build in context and narrative, it's part of how, you know, newspapers ended up becoming sort of daily magazines, is all the analytics are baked in because the reporters are able to, check stuff as they go, and he or she can just jam it right in there. Now, the business model has not kept up with that, and the movie, Page One, does a really good job of capturing an incredibly scary time about whether fundamental questions of survival were being asked about the New York Times and other organizations. And did I worry that somewhere in there when I was doing a big job cut story that eventually I would type my own name? Yes, I did. It was really scary for a while. It's less scary now.
Do you ever feel like your brain isn't really equipped to sort through and synthesize all the information that you're inputting into your brain?
I'm sorry, what was the question? I'm kidding, Terry. Yes, I worry about it constantly because, number one, in writing terms, if I become good on Twitter, will I lose my ability to think long thoughts? Number two, my nightstand is groaning with Netflix, with an iPad, with books that, you know, my friends have written about, things I'm interested in and I haven't gotten to them. So it sort of implicates me sitting there. And meanwhile, you know, I walk through Times Square and I see messages on Zipper. I go to buy groceries. There's more messages. I ride the elevator up here. There's more messages. And I think that it does sort of paralyze you. My more sort of persistent concern is that I will become so busy producing media that I won't consume enough of it, so that what I produce becomes less and less rich over time. What it reminds me of is being at a convention, whether it's a political convention or South by Southwest, or covering a big story like 9/11 or Katrina, all of those things I've done. When you're in the middle of things and pushing out a lot of information, you really have no idea what's going on because you have no time to watch or listen or consume. That's my problem at 55 years old. I don't notice it among my younger colleagues. They don't. Brian Stelter, who's also in the film, the act of producing media and consuming media, those are not discrete things to him. He does both at the same time, in a way I don't. I can remember when bin Laden was killed by U.S. forces, about the time I was going, maybe we should do a blog post about this, I opened up the media blog that I work on, and Brian Stelter, my colleague, already had 700 words up there. And so I'm like, you know, it's like I'm working through Jell-O and he's not. He's in a different sort of universe. But I'm familiar with all the platforms, have engaged in them. I mean, I set up a fully equipped studio in my basement and wrote and edited video and sent it out to the world every day. They ended up looking like hostage videos. They were horrible. It's still, I got the experience and I learned to do it. And I've never understood some of my colleagues saying, oh, that crap's for someone else. It's like, that maybe would have worked 5 years ago, but that isn't going to work anymore.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Carr, and he writes a column on the business of media Mondays for the New York Times. He also writes about popular culture for the Times. A few years ago, you wrote a very personal memoir about being addicted and recovering from the addictions, and the addictions were coke and crack, and you had alcohol problems, too. The book is called Night of the Gun. And, you know, I'm just wondering, like, did the New York Times, when you got your job after you were clean, after you were sober and you got your job with the New York Times, how much did they know about the addiction part of your past? I mean, it's not the kind of thing you put on your resume, but did you talk to them
about
it?
I actually did.
Did you really?
In terms of, like, my communication to them. I mean, I didn't want there to be any surprises about sort of who I am and what I've done. What I tried to emphasize is, you know, I was a very low bottom, poly addicted, crackhead drunk, whatever you want to call it, number of misdemeanor arrests, violence against all sorts of people. And what I wanted to point out is that since then, you know, I'd been a single parent. I had gotten off of welfare, that I had taken any number of assignments and done a good job, that I had run newspapers, that I had done a few things since then. But still, when I did the book, you know, I went to my boss, Sam Sifton, at the time, and he said, I'll walk the book down there, but I think you probably should do it. And I said, well, do you have a pair of tongs or oven mitts or something that I can use to hand it over? Because it was a very... it's kind of a dark book. And when I gave it to him, Bill Keller said, you know what, we don't hire nuns. We have no problem with your book. You know, they said they were proud of the book.
So this question is probably way too personal. So just...
I bet not.
Well, just tell me if it is, because I don't want to be intrusive. For a lot of people who are giving up an addiction, they're encouraged to, like, find a higher power that they can, you know, turn to and believe in, whether it's religion or something else that will function in that way. Was there such a thing for you?
You know, it's funny you should mention that, because I'm in the middle of sort of a struggle with that. And it's not that I am a church-going Catholic, and I do that as a matter of, it's good to stand with my family. It's good that I didn't have to come up with my own creation myth for my children. It's a wonderful group of people that I go to church with, and it's community. It's not really where I find God. And sort of what the accommodation I've reached is a very jerry-rigged one, which is all along the way in recovery, I've been helped, without getting into the names of specific groups, by all of these strangers, you know, who get in a room and do a form of group talk therapy and live by certain rules in their life. And one of the rules is that you help everyone who needs help. And I think to myself, well, that seems remarkable. And not only is that not a general human impulse, but it's not an impulse of mine. And yet I found myself doing that over and over again. So am I, underneath all things, just a really wonderful, giving person, or is there a force greater than myself that is leading me to act in ways that are altruistic and not self-interested and lead to the greater good? And so that's sort of as far as I've gotten with the higher power thing, is I'm, you know, I'm kind of a pirate, kind of a thug. I mean, I've done a bunch of terrible things, and yet I'm able to, for the most part, be a decent person. How is that? Do I have some inner strength of character? I think not. I think something else is working on me.
So in the spirit of reflection about whether you will have a higher power in your life and what that higher power will be, how are you thinking about it? Like, Are you reading things you hadn't read before? I mean, how do you figure that out?
One of the things that I'm doing is praying, which seems like a really uncomfortable, unnatural activity for me. It's to whom, to what, about what, you know, I have a prayer in my wallet that I'm saying, and I feel like a complete fraud while I'm doing it. But it's the act of acknowledging that there may be something else out there. And so it isn't, I haven't really thought it through, but I think the behavior and the activity will sort of lead to something good. Anything that sort of gets me into a place of something less than self-obsession and gets me into a place of some humility, not even acknowledging a higher power, but that other people exist and they're not here as an extension of my world. I think that part of the reason I got involved in journalism is I love the stories of other people. I mean, everybody's got a story to tell. When all these layoff stories were coming, I was just thinking to myself, good Lord, what if I would have to go and get a real job? How horrible would that be? Because I view what I do as something of a caper, not really work.
So your voice has a kind of hoarseness to it.
Right.
A little raspy. Was it always that way, or is that related to the drugs that you did back then, or to the cancer that you had after that?
You know, it's a little tough to pin down because I've smoked on and off all my life tobacco. So a lot of people who smoke tobacco sound like me. When you smoke cocaine, you're taking in vapors that are coming into your lungs at a really high temperature. And so could that have made a problem? I had Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I took a lot of radiation to the mouth and throat. So could it have been that? I mean, I have, I walk around, and you can see in the movie, page one, I walk around with my neck bent. That's from the muscles sort of getting shot out by all the radiation. I will tell you something interesting, though. I spent a couple weeks working 9/11, you know, working the pile. My job was to cover a fireman. I never had a hoarse voice before that.
Really?
So I think that's when it declared itself. And it sort of comes and goes based on the amount of fatigue I have. I could have surgery to remove the vocal notes, but I've had a lot of surgeries. I've had a very medicalized life. I have no spleen, I have one kidney, I have no gallbladder, I have half a pancreas. And the idea of sort of willingly allowing people to cut into me, I'm probably not for that. I'll just deal with the hoarseness of the voice.
Well, David Carr, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure to speak with you, Terry.
David Carr speaking with Terry Gross. Carr's media column is published Mondays in the New York Times business section. He's featured in the documentary Page One, which follows the Times media desk over the course of a year. It's just come out on DVD. Deer Tick has just released its fourth album, called Divine Providence. It's the second album this year from lead singer John McCauley, who put out Middle Brother, a collaboration with other musicians, this past March. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed that album, too, and says the new Deer Tick album steers this Providence, Rhode Island band in a more raw-sounding direction.
I got a lust for life and a dangerous mind. My trail of dust, who knows what you'll find. I can take a tree and tear it from its roots.
The title of Deer Tick's new album, Divine Providence, is a pun. The band hails from the capital of Rhode Island. But the other side of the pun is sarcastic. There's little concerning divine providence or care. Neither is the band provident, frugal, or prudent about its talent and music. Group frontman John McCauley continues to sing as though the primary idea is to shred his vocal cords. And on this album, the goal is to convey something of the band's live performances, a headlong mixture of loud guitars and cover songs, plus originals that remind you of songs they might cover. That's Deer Tick channeling their inner Ramones on You Got It, Let's All Go to the Bar. The music on Divine Providence is pickled in alcohol. Songs that don't contain references to drinking sound as though they were recorded under its influence, if not both combined. But it's not alcoholic music, that is, made without control or an awareness of what's at stake in committing to this pose. The booze fuels both frantic moments and more contemplative ones. Most of the time, Deer Tick is happy to summon up the influences of the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, and the Replacements. A bonus track buried a full half hour after the disc supposedly ends is Mr. Cigarette, written for the band by the Replacements' Paul Westerberg. Then there's their Phil Spector meets Rod Stewart mashup, a fine mid-tempo rocker called Main Street.
I can't sleep, I can't close my eyes.
Still in his 20s, Macaulay has been influenced by some good stuff. In concert, he's been known to have Deer Tick cover music by Hank Williams, John Prine, and Michael Hurley. The group has occasionally done entire sets devoted to renditions of Nirvana songs, advertising these performances under the band name Deervana. You can listen to this album Divine Providence and dismiss it as a juvenile party record. After all, the song that began this review, The Bump, features the shouted chorus, "We're full-grown men, but we act like kids." True enough, as far as it goes. But as Deer Tick has proved in the past, and probably will elaborate further in the future, this is also a band attuned to using its music to work through various kinds of pain. The pains you can't just numb with a lot of whiskey and some slashing guitar chords.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Deer Tick's new album, Divine Providence. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. One of the standout characters in the HBO series Boardwalk Empire is Federal Agent Nelson Van Alden, played by our next guest, Michael Shannon. Shannon also stars in the new movie Take Shelter and was nominated for an Oscar for his role in Revolutionary Road. Terry spoke with Shannon last week. Boardwalk Empire is set in Atlantic City during Prohibition. Shannon is a Prohibition agent with the Department of Internal Revenue, and he's left his wife at home while on assignment in Atlantic City. Devoutly Christian, he finds himself surrounded by sinful temptations, to which he eventually succumbs. Last season, he drank liquor at a speakeasy and had sex with the former girlfriend of a crime boss, and got her pregnant. Worse yet, he drowned his partner while trying to baptize him, and feels responsible for another agent who was caught in an explosion at a bootlegger's warehouse. Van Alden's wife is unaware of all this, but in this weekend's episode, fearing he's about to be exposed, he calls her.
I want you to know, it's important that you know, that everything I've done is because I love you.
Nelson, you're frightening me.
I have sinned, Rose, and a good and decent man has burned for those sins.
Listen to me.
It's all right, dear. I've made my peace. I'm neither fit for you, nor am I fit to wear this badge.
Nelson,
I love you.
Michael Shannon, welcome to Fresh Air. Pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
When you accepted the part in Boardwalk Empire, did you know that this righteous federal agent and Christian was going to succumb to all kinds of temptations in his work and in his personal life?
Not really. I was kind of blindsided by it, honestly. Terry did mention in the original meeting.
This is Terrence Winter, who co-created the show.
Exactly. He mentioned that one of the themes of the show was going to be how Atlantic City can corrupt people. I guess it's kind of like, you know, the snake in the garden, how everybody in the story was going to have trials and tribulations because of being in Atlantic City. And, it, you know, the notion that Atlantic City may be some sort of black hole that you descend into.
I'd like to play what might be your most talked about scene. This is the scene in which you insist on baptizing your partner, Agent Sepso, in the river, and he doesn't want to be baptized because he's Jewish. Now, you correctly suspect that he's been on the take to Nucky Thompson, the boss of the liquor operation in Atlantic City during Prohibition. So in this scene, you've brought him to a spot on the river where a local African-American church conducts baptisms. And the preacher who is in the water performing baptisms as you arrive. He sees you and speaks first.
Agent Van Alden of the Bureau of Internal Revenue. Have you come here to be accepted into the arms of Christ?
I have never left him, Deacon. Be gone. Though I have at times turned from his love.
You cannot turn from him, sir. Whatsoever the compass point, he's there beside you.
I do know that to be so. But this man does not. There is a veil over his eyes, Deacon, and a darkness in his soul.
Come forward.
No, thank you.
Young sir, come forward.
No, thank you.
Come forward, Mr. Sepso.
I'd really rather not.
You insult these good people and their beliefs?
They're not my beliefs.
What are you afraid of, Mr. Sepso?
I'm not afraid.
Then let these waters wash you clean.
So you finally get Agent Sepso, who again is Jewish, into the water, and you have the pastor's permission to baptize him. You keep dunking his head underwater, and he keeps declining to be baptized. And in your zeal to baptize him, you keep his head underwater so long you end up drowning him. So let's hear that part of the scene. And in this part of the scene, the pastor is getting worried that you're hurting Agent Sepso, and he tries to intervene, but you keep on dunking him until you kill him. The pastor speaks first.
This is not a battle, sir.
You're wrong, Deacon. It is a battle against the devil himself. I have seen him abroad in the daylight and the night, and by God, I will force him out. Thou hast fulfilled the judgment of the wicked.
Well, you just killed this guy, and you're praising God that thou hast fulfilled the judgment of the wicked. You say about this agent who you've just killed that there's a darkness in his soul. And, of course, that really describes your character. There is a real darkness in your soul.
Yes. Well, I think with Van Alden, probably like most people, his problems began in childhood. I imagine him coming from a very strict background, probably not a very compassionate background. I imagine his father being somewhat of an ogre. And maybe even, you know, physically abusing him from time to time. And so that's kind of the seed of what grows into the adult Van Alden. But I think he's a very sad character because I do believe he ultimately has good intentions and he wants to do the right thing. And he goes to Atlantic City believing that he can do some good in the world. And as many nefarious activities as he gets up to, he's also surrounded by people thwarting him at every turn. So that act of drowning Sepso is the culmination of a great deal of frustration and despair on his part.
Have you known anybody who is as much, you know, a zealot and delusional at the same time as the agent who you portray is?
You know, I've known a lot of very religious people. My mother is very religious, but she was also very is very private about it. She when I was growing up, she never went to church. She just prayed and read her Bible and kept it to herself. So I'm not from a background of flamboyant believers. It's much more a personal issue. But you know, it's very important to me not to judge Van Alden or to judge people in general. When you're an actor, it can be a hindrance, I think, if you look askance at people, you know.
At the same time, though, you've tried to create a backstory for him so you can understand what he's been through that shaped him. And you were telling us, for instance, that you assume his father might have abused him when he was young, and he abuses himself. There's a scene in the first season where, because he feels sexually attracted to somebody who he should not, she's not his wife, and she's Nucky's mistress, you very carefully lay out, like, a towel on the bed. You carefully lay out your belt over the towel, and then you take off your shirt, and then you lift the belt and knot it, and then start flagellating yourself.
Right.
And it's like such a surprise, like you're not prepared. I mean, the viewer is not prepared for that. But is that one of the reasons why you assume that the agent's father beat him when the agent was a child, and now he beats himself?
Yes, I think this behavior he probably learned from his father. But I think one of the things that's so striking about the scene, like you say, is that it's very ritualistic. And it's not histrionic, you know, or hysterical. It's very methodical.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is one of the fascinating things about Van Alden's journey, is seeing him not only lose control of maybe his reason or his perspective, but I think along the way he loses control of that methodic, ritualistic sense of himself. To me, it's much more horrifying to actually see Van Alden take a drink than it is to see him whip himself with the belt, because the drink is something that Van Alden has told himself his whole life that he would never, ever do under any circumstances. So for me, playing the part, it was actually a lot more difficult to show up and do the scene where he walks into a speakeasy and has a shot of whiskey and then goes over and talks to Lucy than it was to do the flagellation scene.
You're very tall. How tall are you?
I'm 6'4".
And you used your size in some of your roles in a very imposing way, like in Boardwalk Empire. And in Boardwalk Empire, you are so, like, tall and imposing, yet so disconnected from your body. I mean, the body is a source of sin and temptation. There's almost something Frankensteinish about it, in the sense that, like, Frankenstein is a brain inside this body that the brain doesn't belong in. So, like, the body just doesn't know how to move. The body is so stiff and kind of rigid. And, like, that's what your body is. You are so out of touch with it.
Well, I think that's another thing, another aspect of Van Alden that probably germinated in his childhood. I imagine that he was always told not to slouch, to sit up straight, and to have good posture. And I think it is a Frankenstein scenario in a way, because I think inside of Van Alden is a child, that arrested child that never really got to develop its own identity. I think as much as he believes that he's operating from these deeply held beliefs, he's actually, in a way, very hollow. I don't think he has even begun to really explore who he really is. So I think that is very exciting for the trajectory of the character, because this season, I mean, you can already see that he's really painting himself into a corner. He's going to have to reinvent himself.
I just want to say something about your face. A couple of distinctive things about your face is that you have very full lips, and they're often, like, depending on the role, like when there's a lot of tension in your face or pain or inwardness, they tend to, like, really turn down your lips, you know, like turn down with the expression of tension. And I never know whether you're thinking about that or whether you're just thinking the emotion and that's what happens.
Oh, gee. Well, you can get into pretty dicey territory there if you're...
with trying to, like, move your lips or something?
Yeah, if you're just trying to manipulate... It's a very delicate thing because, you know, film and television, it's photography. This is going to sound kind of ridiculous, but in a way you're kind of modeling a story. You know, you have to be conscious of the fact that it's being photographed, whereas in theater you really are just trying to get to the heart of the matter. You know, I've had experiences on film where I really felt what was happening, and I felt like it couldn't be any more perfect than what it was. It just seemed like exactly what it needed to be. And then I've seen it, and it's completely the opposite of what I thought, or you don't see anything. And I had this experience recently where I was working on something and doing a take and over and over, and I talked to the director, and he'd say, well, what about this or what about that? And I said, oh, okay. And then finally I just did a take where I kind of turned my head a slightly different angle, and it worked. And he was like, oh, that's perfect. I was like, all I did was I just turned my head a little bit. He's like, well, trust me, it's exactly what I wanted. So we'd been having all these, you know, high-minded conversations about what my character was thinking or what he wanted, and really all I needed to do was, you know, turn my head 45 degrees. But by and large, to your original question, I'm trying not to think about that aspect of it. I still try to focus just on what my character's trying to do.
So you've played so many eccentric characters, bordering some of them on crazy. Do you think of yourself as eccentric?
I guess I do. Partially, it's just the life of an actor. It's an unusual life. It's hard, you know, if you walk downtown past all the people with the, you know, their briefcases and going about their daily routine, that it's hard to feel like a member of that society, I guess, because it's just not what you do. You know, I feel like I'm settling down. I had a very long period where I had led this kind of gypsy-like existence, traveling a lot and not really putting roots down anywhere. But now I starting a family and settling down. That's also, my life is a little less, I used to not have much money and it was hard to get by sometimes, and now I have a little bit more comfort and security in that department. But I think more than anything, what it is I'm just a very incredibly sensitive person. I think most actors are, you know. I'm very sensitive to what goes on around me, and I'm very, I feel like I'm always kind of paying attention to everything. Like I don't have blinders, or I don't have a lot of maybe defense mechanisms that other people have.
At the same time, when you're an actor, you're facing so much rejection and not getting roles and getting bad reviews. Not that you've gotten bad reviews, but I mean, like, what actor doesn't have to face that? So, like, the sensitivity can be a real problem. You have to be kind of thick-skinned. Yeah,
and I have. I've dealt with a lot of that, you know. I think with anybody you see who makes it to the, I don't know, this level of the public eye, you know, it's easy to forget that everybody, even the famous people, put up with a lot of rejection, you know. There's a lot of parts I haven't gotten, and I have gotten a lot of bad reviews. Some of, you know, right when I started in Chicago, the first play I got cast in outside of, you know, an academic environment, I was fired from. I was a little tiny storefront theater in Chicago, you know, folding chairs and clamp lights, the whole nine yards. And it's called, I think it was called West Bank Story. And I rehearsed for a couple of weeks, and then one day the director walked up to me and said, you know, you have a lot of raw talent, but you should go to the conservatory or something and learn some technique, because you're just too, we can't figure out how to get you to do what we want you to do. And so I gave her the finger and left. And,
did you go to the conservatory?
No, I didn't go to the conservatory. I went and actually went and did some electrical work, laying cables in a theater. And then a few months later, I went back and gave it another shot. And the rest is history.
Right. Okay. Yeah. It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Terry.
Michael Shannon speaking with Terry Gross. Shannon plays Prohibition agent Nelson Van Alden in HBO's Boardwalk Empire and stars in the new movie Take Shelter. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancourt.